Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, Part 3 continued.
Disc 4.
Chapter 6. The Concerto of Deliverance. On October 20th, the Steelworkers Union of Reardon Steel demanded a raise in wages. Hank Reardon learned it from the newspapers. No demand had been presented to him, and it had not been considered necessary to inform him. The demand was made to the Unification Board. It was not explained why no other steel company was presented with a similar claim. He was unable to tell whether the demanders did or did not represent his workers, the board's rules on union elections having made it a matter impossible to define. He learned only that the group consisted of those newcomers whom the board had slipped into his mills in the past few months. On October 23rd, the Unification Board rejected the union's petition, refusing to grant the raise. If any hearings had been held on the matter, Reardon had not known about it. He had not been consulted, informed, or notified. He had waited, volunteering no questions. On October 25th, the newspapers of the country, controlled by the same men who controlled the board, began a campaign of commiseration with the workers of Reardon Steel. They printed stories about the refusal of the wage raise, omitting any mention of who had refused it or who held the exclusive legal power to refuse, as if counting on the public to forget legal technicalities under a barrage of stories implying that an employer was the natural cause of all misery suffered by employees. They printed a story describing the hardships of the workers of Reardon Steel under the present rise in the cost of their living, next to a story describing Hank Reardon's profits of 5 years ago. They printed a story on the plight of a Reardon worker's wife trudging from store to store in a hopeless quest for food, next to a story about a champagne bottle broken over somebody's head at a drunken party given by an unnamed steel tycoon at a fashionable hotel. The steel tycoon had been Orrin Boyle, but the story mentioned no names. "Inequalities still exist among us," the newspapers were saying, "and cheat us of the benefits of our enlightened age. Privations have worn the nerves and temper of the people. The situation is reaching the danger point. We fear an outbreak of violence." "We fear an outbreak of violence," the newspapers kept repeating. On October 28th, a group of the new workers at Reardon Steel attacked a foreman and knocked the tuyeres off a blast furnace. 2 days later, a similar group broke the ground floor windows of the administration building. A new worker smashed the gears of a crane, upsetting a ladle of molten metal within a yard of 5 bystanders. "Guess I went nuts worrying about my hungry kids," he said when arrested. "This is no time to theorize about who's right or wrong," the newspapers commented. "Our sole concern is the fact that an inflammatory situation is endangering the steel output of the country." Reardon watched, asking no questions. He waited, as if some final knowledge were in the process of unraveling before him, a process not to be hastened or stopped. "No," he thought through the early dusk of autumn evenings, looking out the window of his office. No, he was not indifferent to his mills. But the feeling which had once been passion for a living entity was now like the wistful tenderness one feels for the memory of the loved and dead. The special quality of what one feels for the dead, he thought, is that no action is possible any longer. On the morning of October 31st, he received a notice informing him that all of his property, including his bank accounts and safety deposit boxes, had been attached to satisfy a delinquent judgment obtained against him in a trial involving a deficiency in his personal income tax of 3 years ago. It was a formal notice, complying with every requirement of the law, except that no such deficiency had ever existed, and no such trial had ever taken place. "No," he said to his indignation-choked attorney. "Don't question them. Don't answer. Don't object."
"But this is fantastic."
"Any more fantastic than the rest?"
"Hank, do you want me to do nothing? To take it lying down?"
"No, standing up. And I mean standing. Don't move. Don't act."
"But they've left you helpless."
"Have they?" he asked softly, smiling. He had a few $100 in cash left in his wallet, nothing else. But the odd glowing warmth in his mind, like the feel of a distant handshake, was the thought that, in a secret safe of his bedroom, there lay a bar of solid gold, given to him by a gold-haired pirate. Next day, on November 1st, he received a telephone call from Washington, from a bureaucrat whose voice seemed to come sliding down the wire on its knees in protestations of apology. "A mistake, Mr. Reardon. It was nothing but an unfortunate mistake. That attachment was not intended for you. You know how it is nowadays with the inefficiency of all office help and with the amount of red tape we're tangled in. Some bungling fool mixed the records and processed the attachment order against you when it wasn't your case at all. It was, in fact, the case of a soap manufacturer. Please accept our apologies, Mr. Reardon, our deepest personal apologies at the top level." The voice slid to a slight, expectant pause. "Mr. Reardon?"
"I'm listening."
"I can't tell you how sorry we are to have caused you any embarrassment or inconvenience. And with all those damn formalities that we have to go through, you know how it is, red tape. It will take a few days, perhaps a week, to deprocess that order and to lift the attachment." "Mr. Reardon?"
"I heard you."
"We're desperately sorry, and ready to make any amends within our power. You will, of course, be entitled to claim damages for any inconvenience this might cause you, and we are prepared to pay. We won't contest it. You will, of course, file such a claim, and..."
"I've not said that."
No, you haven't. That is... Well, what have you said, Mr. Reardon?"
"I have said nothing."
Late on the next afternoon, another voice came pleading from Washington. This one did not seem to slide, but to bounce on the telephone wire with the gay virtuosity of a tightrope walker. It introduced itself as Tinky Holloway, and pleaded that Reardon attend a conference. An informal little conference, just a few of us, the top-level few, to be held in New York at the Wayne Falkland Hotel day after next. "There have been so many misunderstandings in the past few weeks," said Tinky Holloway. "Such unfortunate misunderstandings, and so unnecessary. We could straighten everything out in a jiffy, Mr. Reardon, if we had a chance to have a little talk with you. We're extremely anxious to see you."
"You can issue a subpoena for me any time you wish."
"Oh, no, no, no!" The voice sounded frightened. "No, Mr. Reardon, why think of such things? You don't understand us. We're anxious to meet you on a friendly basis. We're seeking nothing but your voluntary cooperation." Holloway paused tensely, wondering whether he had heard the faint sound of a distant chuckle. He waited, but heard nothing else. "Mr. Reardon?"
"Yes."
"Surely, Mr. Reardon, at a time like this, a conference with us could be to your great advantage."
"A conference about what?"
"You've encountered so many difficulties, and we're anxious to help you in any way we can."
"I have not asked for help."
"These are precarious times, Mr. Reardon. The public mood is so uncertain and inflammatory, so... dangerous. And we want to be able to protect you."
"I've not asked for protection."
"But surely you realize that we're in a position to be of value to you. And if there's anything you want from us, any..."
"There isn't."
"But you must have problems you'd like to discuss with us."
"I haven't."
"Then..." "Well, then..."
Giving up the attempt at the play of granting a favor, Holloway switched to an open plea.
"Then won't you just give us a hearing?"
"If you have anything to say to me."
"We have, Mr. Reardon, we certainly have. That's all we're asking for, a hearing. Just give us a chance. Just come to this conference. You wouldn't be committing yourself to anything." He said it involuntarily, and stopped, hearing a bright, mocking stab of life in Reardon's voice, an unpromising sound, as Reardon answered,
"I know it."
"Well, I mean, that is... Well, then, will you come?"
"All right," said Reardon. "I'll come." He did not listen to Holloway's assurances of gratitude. He noted only that Holloway kept repeating,
"At 7 p.m., November 4th, Mr. Reardon. November 4th. As if the date had some special significance.
Reardon dropped the receiver and lay back in his chair, looking at the glow of furnace flames on the ceiling of his office. He knew that the conference was a trap. He knew also that he was walking into it with nothing for any trappers to gain. Tinky Holloway dropped the receiver in his Washington office and sat up tensely, frowning. Claude Slagenhop, president of Friends of Global Progress, who had sat in an armchair, nervously chewing a matchstick,
glanced up at him and asked,
"Not so good?"
Holloway shook his head.
"He'll come, but no, not so good,"
he added.
"I don't think he'll take it."
"That's what my punk told me."
"I know."
"The punk said we'd better not try it."
"God damn your punk, we've got to. We'll have to risk it."